Nobody needs to be reminded what happened 20 years ago today. Those who are old enough to remember it will never forget it. Those who are not have grown up in a world substantially defined by it. The United States chose to interpret the attacks of September 11th, 2001, not only as an act of terror, but of war. But what started in late 2001 did not end there. The war on terror mutated into the forever war, fought on the ground and from the air in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, and elsewhere. That heavy toll of 3,000 killed on 9/11 was dwarfed by hundreds of thousands of subsequent deaths, combatants and civilians, along with millions of casualties and displacements. Within that war, some battles have been won. Osama bin Laden is dead. Al-Qaeda is not, at the risk of tempting fate, the threat it once was. Iraq is no longer a tyranny. The caliphate of the Islamic State, though arguably a byproduct of the war on terror, was defeated and dismantled. And give or take one or two spree shooters whose claims of fealty may have been largely delusional, there has not been a major Islamist terror attack upon the American homeland since 9/11, certainly nothing approaching the scale of that day's horrors. Now, the forever war is, in theory, over, ended amid scenes of grotesque chaos last month as the US abandoned Afghanistan after nearly two decades and returned it to the Taliban. What has been the reward for the lives and resources consumed by the war on terror? What have we learned? And are we any safer? This is the Foreign Desk.
We are dramatically safer today from terrorist threats than we were 20 years ago. Our counterterrorism capabilities across the board are significantly better.
Ideas have no borders. And what we've learned the hard way, certainly from the so-called Islamic State and their ability to get foreign fighters in from all over the world, is that if we don't work on the ideological dimension of this war, we have a long way to go.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined, first of all, from Washington, D.C. by Nathan Sales, former Acting Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy and Human Rights at the U.S. Department of State, and former Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism. We're also joined by Dr. David Kilcullen, CEO of Cordillera Applications Group. A former Australian Army officer, David served as a counterinsurgency advisor to the United States during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and is the author of several books on guerrilla warfare. David joins us from Denver. Nathan, I will start by asking you, is there a shortish answer to what I know is the complicated question of what we, by which I guess I mean the United States and the wider West, have actually got right in our 20-year-long response to what happened 20 years ago today?
It's a great question. I think there's a lot of pessimism these days. The conventional wisdom against the backdrop of the calamitous withdrawal from Afghanistan is that it wasn't worth it. But I think it's important to take a fresh look at what we actually have accomplished. And it's quite an impressive list. We are dramatically safer today from terrorist threats than we were 20 years ago. Our counterterrorism capabilities across the board are significantly better. It's not an accident that we have gone 20 years without a major terrorist attack on the U.S. homeland. It is the result of policy changes and resources that have been devoted to the counterterrorism mission over the past 20 years. Now, did we get a lot wrong? Yeah, we did get a lot wrong, but we got a lot right as well. And I think we are benefiting from that today in the form of relative safety at home and relative safety abroad.
David, I want to go back 20 years to the intervention in Afghanistan, which I know we have discussed with you on this program before, especially the rather shambolic withdrawal from it. But does it strike you, with the benefit of hindsight, that the grand nation-building ambition in Afghanistan was a mistake, that maybe there's a more helpful counterfactual in which there's a quickish or limited military operation against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, a limited presence maintained afterwards, maybe something a bit like France's Operation Barkhane in the Sahel? Did we basically expect too much of ourselves and what we're capable of in Afghanistan?
Well, it's not actually counterfactual, right? Because the original US plan going into Afghanistan was exactly that. It was to go in with a limited military operation to knock out Al-Qaeda, to disrupt the Taliban ability to continue to support Al-Qaeda, but then essentially to not try to occupy and nation build. I don't think the ambition of nation building was wrong, because if you want to prevent the reemergence of terrorism from Afghanistan, you need to have a stable enough government to prevent the vacuum that created that problem in the first place. And you need to do a certain amount of nation building. So it wasn't a wrong ambition, but I do think it, when we invaded Iraq and our attention was dragged away somewhere else and we didn't have the resources to respond when the Taliban began to recover, that's when the effort in Afghanistan sort of went off the rails.
Nathan, where does it strike you that that direction towards what became the forever war came from? Does it strike you, looking back, that that was a rigorously logical, rational path forward, or was there a certain amount of ideological dogmatism underpinning it?
There's a sense in which our Afghan policy was come for the counterterrorism and stay for the nation building. And we're really, really good at counterterrorism. Our military is exceptional at applying overwhelming force to destroy our enemies. What they're not particularly good at is building Switzerland in countries that don't have a long tradition of liberal democracy. And frankly, we don't want them to be good at that. Now, I agree with David that in order to do counterterrorism effectively, you need to have a local partner and a sufficient amount of stability for that local partner to be able to operate basic security services. And I think the model for this is actually Syria, in which the United States and an 83-member coalition managed to destroy the so-called physical caliphate using a minimum U.S. military presence on the ground, but working hand in glove with Kurdish militias who bear the brunt of the fighting with U.S. and NATO and other allied air support. I think it's politically sustainable because the footprint is so light. And I think it's also operationally sustainable because it doesn't draw the enormous amount of resources that we now are seeing being redeployed to great power competition.
Just to follow that up quickly, Nathan, though, taking on board what you said about the success of the operation to confront and dismantle the physical caliphate of Islamic State, is there not, however, an argument that what you ended up dealing with there was a consequence of the original intervention, i.e. that Islamic State was itself a byproduct of the invasion of Iraq?
I think one thing we can say with certainty is that the rise of ISIS in Iraq and Syria was a direct result of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2011. With no American military presence on the ground, our diplomacy was enfeebled. We didn't have leverage that we needed to maintain peace and stability among the various different ethnic and sectarian factions in Iraq. And the result was calamitous. Islamic State created a so-called caliphate that was the size of Pennsylvania. And we saw the results in Paris and Brussels with their global terrorist ambitions. I would have hoped that Iraq would have been a cautionary tale to the Biden White House, having seen what happens when you prematurely withdraw American military muscle and the security vacuums that emerge. My hope would have been that they would have learned some hard lessons from that and applied them to Afghanistan, but unfortunately, that doesn't appear to be the case.
I want to pick up on something that Nathan said earlier. There's really been three times during the entire war on terror so far where we've had very notable success, and they have a certain couple of characteristics in common. The first was the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, where about 110 CIA guys and about 300 special forces successfully overthrew the Taliban in about 7 weeks. But they had 50,000 Afghans fighting on their side, doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the combat sense. Likewise, during the surge period in Iraq, we partnered with local groups on the ground who came to be known as the Awakening, the Sahawa, or the Sons of Iraq. And yes, the US put 28,000 extra troops in for the surge, but we had 110,000 Iraqis fighting with us against Al-Qaeda and all their families. So maybe 500,000 people in total who literally changed sides from the insurgency to support us. And that was the one period where we had really significant success in reducing the violence in Iraq. The third time, which Nathan already mentioned, was in Syria, where we partnered with local groups to do much of the combat. And the common features here were small US commitment, significant air component and special operations component, most of the ground fighting being done by locals. And very importantly, they always had a bigger stake in it than we did. And so they were motivated to fight with our support. At other times, we've tended to do the heavy lifting for our partners. And that breeds a complacency and it breeds a dependence on us and a belief that, hey, the Americans won't let this fail. So we don't really need to try as hard. And I think we saw that at different times in Iraq and in just now in Afghanistan. So I think there's a important lesson here that you absolutely don't want to abandon people as we did in Iraq, which led to the rise of ISIS. I fully agree with that. And we've just obviously done that in Afghanistan. We're probably going to see another decade of the war on terror as a result. But there's a middle ground between completely abandoning people and coming in with 150,000 troops and a massive aid program and a US general and a 3,000 person embassy and sort of taking it all over. And you want to find that pivot point where it's sort of light footprint, small scale engagement where you don't own it, right? You're just there to help. And I think that to the extent that we can do that, that's a model that has worked in the last 20 years.
Nathan, one significant moment, or certainly victory in the war on terror, which we have alluded to, was the tracking down, cornering and killing of Osama bin Laden in 2011. Was that perhaps seen as more of a big deal by the United States than it was seen as a big deal at that point by the United States enemies?
I think it was a big deal in a couple of different respects. First of all, operationally, there was this sense that bin Laden was removed from the day-to-day management of al-Qaeda. But it turns out when you review the treasure trove of documents that our operators took off the compound, that he was really involved in providing strategic direction to al-Qaeda. Anytime you're able to take the strategic leaders off the battlefield, you weaken the organization. But we also have to be mindful of the propaganda value. We showed the entire world and we showed our terrorist enemies that we can get them. No matter where you go, you might be in the Pakistani equivalent of West Point. We can get you there. We are patient. We're going to find you and we have the reach to take you out. Bottom line is, anytime you make the bad guys play defense, which is what we did in Abbottabad, you're taking away the bandwidth that they otherwise would be using to play offense against our homeland and our allies.
David, does it strike you that this is an advantage that has been developed over the last 20 years, which is going to be continually useful to us, that ability to find and, if necessary, kill individual terrorists, individual terror leaders? Does the disruption counterbalance what you lose going the other way in terms of innocent lives taken, and thousands have been by drone strikes over the last 20 years. I'm always put uncomfortably in mind of having interviewed many years ago Sadi Yassef, who was the Front Liberation National commander in Algeria, who simply said to me, this is the thing with targeting terrorists. You kill one, you create 10.
So the short answer to all that is no. We are not going to be able to continue to do what we did with respect to Osama bin Laden or Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi or even Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, because those things relied on having a presence in country with assets positioned close to the location. They relied on having allies in country and a friendly government and a network of intelligence sources and the ability to position those close to a potential target, which meant that there was a short time loop in terms of identifying a target and being able to action that. What we're going to now, this so-called over-the-horizon model, is not going to work. And it will take us back to the 1990s, where our decision-making loop is too long for the ability of terrorists to move. And I agree with Nathan's point that we need to make these guys play defense so that they're not able to plan and operate against us. The best way to do that, and the only way we know that really works, is to have our people forward partnering with friendly local networks on the ground. It's just not feasible to do it from a long distance by drone with no ground assets or no partners on the ground. That's when you do get a lot of civilians getting killed, because something that looks like a terrorist gathering might turn out to be a wedding party, for example. And when you've got your partnership on the ground, as we did until a month ago in Afghanistan, it is folly, in my view, to just throw that away. And I think we're about to see the fruits of that in Afghanistan as well, we have basically been blinded in terms of our ability to keep track of these guys. And it's going to be much, much more difficult now than it was even a few months ago to try to keep them on the defensive.
We are coming to the end of the show, so I will press you each for one concluding thought. And David, I will start with you. Your most recent book looked at asymmetric warfare, the dragons and the snakes, the dragons being the world superpowers and the snakes being the kind of people that at least this superpower has been fighting for 20 years. In an asymmetric war like that, is it the fact that the superpower is invariably doomed, ultimately, because the local guerrilla organization, as we have just seen in Afghanistan, really basically only has to wait them out?
In Afghanistan, we made their job a lot easier by telling them during the surge exactly how long they had to wait. And we then made it easier again by giving away enormous amounts of our leverage at the beginning of the negotiating process a couple of years ago. Assuming that you don't make those unforced errors, it is certainly possible for a large power to defeat an asymmetric rival. But what's really important here is to understand there's an asymmetry of motivation and commitment, as well as an asymmetry of equipment and technique, right? So we look very different and we act very different from a group like the Taliban. But most importantly, they're fighting for survival in their own country. And the risk that we have is that our politicians in particular will just lose interest and wander off and go and do something else because they don't really care about it as much.
Nathan, there is, as you will know, a conventional wisdom as well, and I think rather a lazy and ill-considered one, that extremism, terrorism, especially in a Middle Eastern context, are exclusively a reaction to malign or incompetent American policy. In terms not of strategy, but of policy, has the United States learnt anything useful from the last 20 years about how it comports itself in the Middle East in particular, or is it just making the same mistakes over and over again?
I think it's a very lazy assumption to attribute to our jihadist enemies motivations that are not actually the reason for their behavior. I think we have to take them at their word. Bin Laden declared war on the United States in the late 1990s because American troops were in Saudi Arabia to prevent Iraq under Saddam Hussein from coming across the border like he did in Kuwait in 1990. And it doesn't have to be any more complex than that. It's too simple and too lazy to say that Bin Laden hates America for reasons that members of the faculty club are criticizing America. It's not that simple. I think we have to take seriously what our jihadist enemies say. And what they're saying is they want to create a paradise on earth that is governed by Sharia, and they will fight using violent methods, including targeting civilians, any obstacle that prevents them from realizing that vision.
Nathan Sales and David Kilcullen, thank you both very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk. You're listening to The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24. As we've already learned in this episode, fighting extremists remains difficult. Have we got any better then at fighting extremism? Well, joining me now from Atlanta is Farah Pandith, a leading expert on counter-extremism, having served as a political appointee in the George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama administrations. Most recently, she served as the first ever special representative to Muslim communities, a post she held until 2014. Farah is also an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Farah, the last 20 years have demonstrated that being involved, especially at a high level, with a major terrorist organization is likely to end badly in imprisonment, death, or it's going to necessitate an awful lot of hiding. All that being the case, do these organizations find it any harder than they once did to attract recruits?
In fact, it's quite the opposite. We have a situation where the technology revolution has given them a weapon that they did not use before, and they've become more and more savvy in how to recruit young people in the online spaces, not just the dark spaces, but the open web, where you would be surprised to see, still at this moment, the ability for them to put forward all kinds of narratives, images, memes that attract people who are interested in learning more about them. What we are seeing is a bonus with the internet, not a decrease, because what's happened is now we have two fronts in which they can radicalize. They can radicalize in an offline way, and they can radicalize in an online way. And I think, to be really clear, you cannot suddenly come into the internet and ask questions that you were not originally thinking about inside of yourself. So radicalization happens around issues of identity and belonging. And so you're feeling something on the inside, and the accelerator is going into an online place where you can find the answers that you're searching for and quickly go down a rabbit hole. So in fact, if you look at the difference between the number of groups, the number of ideological soldiers, and otherwise in a pre-9/11 world, it is a completely different terrorist landscape than the one we see today.
What is at the heart of it? What is the motivation being sold? What is it they want people to be angry about? Has that changed in the last 20 years?
The one thing that we have learned in the 20-year project after 9/11 is that it is connected to emotion, to psychology, to identity, to belonging. Whether you're a neo-Nazi or you're the so-called Islamic State, you are still finding a way for someone to feel like they belong to you. They like what it is that you are selling. And that makes them feel good and makes them feel like they belong to something. It doesn't always have to be anger. It's also this sense of perhaps righteousness, good and bad, right and wrong. And it's very clear that this has been a winning two decades for nefarious actors who want to create a sense of us versus them. And I think we're in a far more dangerous moment in human history than we could have predicted when 9/11 happened.
So given that we have now had 20 years of learning about this stuff the hard way, have we learned anything concrete about how you stop people once they've got one foot into that rabbit hole, how to stop them going much further?
Solutions are available and affordable right now in terms of prevention. We have learned the hard way. We have understood that the military option is not the way to stop the flow of ideas. And ultimately, ideas are what hold people together on this passion project to belong to these extremist groups. One thing we have to think about is what have we learned over 20 years around identity and belonging, and what you need to put into the ecosystem in which a young person navigates their exploration of identity. Let's remember, the human brain is not formed until you are 24 years old. So for us to look at all of these questions that young people have from the time they are in grammar school through high school and college and longer, as they seek answers to how they think about themselves and who they belong to, we know that inserting touch points along that trajectory to move them away from thinking that there are very strident ways to belong or not belong is actually really helpful in this. We also know that former extremists are very authentic and credible voices in how we can take people off that path of radicalization, to find ways to confront this young person that might be interested in joining a neo-Nazi group by putting somebody who is a former neo-Nazi right in front of them to say, let me tell you how I was duped and what I believed and why I left. These are just a couple of examples, but what we have in our pockets right this moment is the pilot projects, the initiatives, the testing of different kinds of things, both online and offline, that we know work. And so the question then, of course, is if you have all these solutions, why are people still getting radicalized? And the answer here is that we have not done an effort at scale that is a whole of society approach. We've done things in a very ad hoc way. We have not put money and resources into the ideological component of the war. And frankly, people's eyes glaze over when you start talking to them about prevention. They want to hear about the tanks and the drones that are going to go after Al-Qaeda. They don't want to know how you build education programs. And I think if we look at what we need to do going forward, the good news is that we aren't starting from zero. We have a lot of data that shows us what works. The bad news is that there's not a government on planet Earth that has been willing to put their time and their resources where their mouth is.
How big a problem would it be that the government is the source of the de-radicalization program? Because it's not hard to see how that could be leveraged towards further radicalization. That the susceptible person is told, well, of course they're saying this, that's what they want you to think, they're the enemy.
So let's be clear, we're not only talking about de-radicalization. That means somebody who has already been radicalized, that you're taking them out and you're trying to deprogram them, okay? I'm talking about prevention. I'm talking about making sure that we don't get ideological soldiers involved in neo-Nazi movements, involved in the so-called Islamic State or the Taliban. I'm talking about all the work that we have to do to make sure that that ideology of us versus them is not appealing. The solution is not just government, it's whole of society. So it's local and state government for sure, and national governments, but it's also business, it's also civil society, and it's also philanthropy that need to work together. Government's greatest strength is to be the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with the ideas that they hear on the ground, and to be able to mobilize an effort. And there we know we have not seen enough direction and leadership toward that end. And so you have civil society organizations that are dependent on small grants here and there, trying to raise funds. And we are looking to civil society to try to plug the hole, to try to stem the tide of this radicalization that happens to young people. And that's not fair. So what we need to do now is to say, what can we do to work together as a whole of society and bring all of these elements in at scale? In a globalized way, by the way, this isn't just about what might be happening in the UK or what might be happening in the United States. Ideas have no borders. And what we've learned the hard way, certainly from the so-called Islamic State and their ability to get foreign fighters in from all over the world, is that if we don't work on the ideological dimension of this war, we have a long way to go.
How much of a role can the media play by reporting terrorism, I guess, better than they do? And do you think the media has learnt anything about it in the last 20 years? Is it, for example, a mistake to portray an undeniably significant figure like Osama bin Laden as this omnipotent, finger-steepling, Bond villain, omniscient danger to us all? Or should he have been treated as a somewhat eccentric and disreputable crank?
I think the media have a very strong role to play in our cultural ecosystem. To say otherwise is ridiculous. We know for sure that Hollywood plays a role. We know that media plays a role. We know that tech companies play a role. And let's not forget that when 9/11 happened, we were all caught off guard on how to report it, how to understand it. Osama bin Laden got press time hours and hours and hours on things like YouTube and various media outlets that broadcast his sermons that allowed him, a criminal, a terrorist, to have a voice that ended up being recruitment videos for new armies to join AQ. So we've learned lessons along the way about what red lines we have, what is permissible, what is not permissible. You can even look to the issue of Christ Church. And you heard very clearly from Jacinda Ardern, I don't want you using his name. I don't want you bringing the terrorists' actions by name because it gives him agency. And I think each nation needs to be very clear about the role that they're playing and how they're conditioning the public to understand these things. And I think, unfortunately, because hate and extremism is a growth industry, and we have been lazy on hate and how we talk about it and how we cover it, we are in a posture in this moment as we, in a sobering way, look at the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and we should be saying, what have we learned from the media perspective and what can we do in a more responsible way as we cover things? I want to say one last thing. I think there has been some positive, smaller changes that may have gone unnoticed. I think the way in which the media has heard from Muslims all over the world on how they speak about Islam, the need for them to be nuanced as they talk about the diversity of Islam, I think some media outlets have actually absorbed that and have tried to do their best to not suggest that Islam is a monolith. And that was a huge problem right after 9/11.
Farah Pandith, thank you. That was the counter-extremism expert Farah Pandith. Her book, How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat, is available now in paperback. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.